Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. I'm producer Cameron Costa, and on today's episode, NVIDIA unveiling a new generation of AI chips and a new software subscription service for whoever buys those chips. NVIDIA investor Paul Meeks explains the business and the science.
What they want to do is make sure, since they already own the pie for large language model building, that they keep their lead in the next stage inference.
And filmmaker George Lucas's message to Disney's Bob Iger, "You've got a friend in me." The battle for Disney's board seats just got even more dramatic.
This is just the next step in the saga that has become this proxy battle. I think Bob Iger has pulled out all the stops.
Plus, a seismic shift in real estate. Real estate CEO Ryan Serhant explains how the National Association of Realtors' $418 million settlement affects every part of your next transaction.
I think there's going to be greater versatility in how you work with your agents.
The Bravo star says the more transparency in this tough business, the better.
Compensation should be a free market conversation, and that's what you're going to have.
It's Tuesday, March 19th, and Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Becky by in 3, 2, 1, cue, please.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. We're live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. I'm Becky Quick along with Joe Kernan. Andrew is out today. Yesterday was an up day for the market.
I hope you realize this is not a concert.
The biggest AI news this week so far, fresh out of NVIDIA.
You have arrived at a developers conference.
In San Jose on Monday, in front of a crowd of 11,000 people, including celebs like Kendrick Lamar, NVIDIA unveiled its newest generation of AI chips, a new version of the giant's graphics processing units, or GPUs. It's called the Blackwell GB200. Up until now, NVIDIA has been producing chips including the H100, or Hopper. Meta and Microsoft, for example, have spent billions to get their hands on NVIDIA's current generation of chips. The newer Blackwell chip will hit markets later this year, and Oracle Cloud, Google Cloud, Amazon's AWS, and Microsoft's Azure have all signed up for this new chip. NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang, who you heard earlier, said the Hopper chip is great, but Blackwell is bigger.
Hopper is fantastic, but we need bigger GPUs. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to introduce you to a very, very big GPU. This is Hopper. Hopper changed the world. This is Blackwell.
Also announced, a new enterprise offering, a software subscription service that offers inference, or the ability to deploy AI models with those NVIDIA GPUs. NVIDIA traded down a percent or so the morning after the announcement, but overall, the share price is up fivefold from late 2022, which was when, if you remember, OpenAI launched ChatGPT and got everyone excited about AI. Let's get back to Becky and Joe.
Our next guest is a tech investor who might actually understand this. He owns NVIDIA and joins us now. Paul Meeks is co-chief investment officer at Harvest Portfolio Management and finance professor at the Citadel for Layman. And I don't know what you are, Paul. You got an engineering degree or a mathematics degree? What can you make this easy for our viewers to understand? I mean, obviously, Becky and I are totally up to speed on this, but can you just make it easier for people that may not be as in the loop as us? What's going on?
I'll tell you this. So it's a larger physical GPU. It actually uses 2-die, which is a very sophisticated manufacturing technique from Taiwan Semiconductor. And you think about it, it's going to provide about 5x the performance of the latest H100 Hopper chip. And so essentially more and more horsepower. They're making a bet that there's going to be a never-ending desire for these chips as we continue to build out these large language models. And so we'll see what happens. You know, in about 3 hours today, they're going to have a meeting for Wall Street analysts like me and we'll be able to hopefully get some guidance as to the financial impact. Because even though the specs here are pretty impressive, you know, they already have about 90% market share in the chips, the GPUs for building large language models. And so maybe this brings greater profitability, but they essentially already own the pie. And so what they announced yesterday, I thought was pretty snappy. Then when, next we can get into the NIM software that they also announced. But what we need to hear is for them to keep their technology lead, specifically over advanced micro devices. And at least last night or yesterday afternoon, I think they checked those boxes, which they needed to check, because of course, the stock is up fivefold since the introduction of ChatGPT a couple of years ago.
Well, better margins or better profits on a stock that a lot of people say is not that expensive relative to other technology stocks. That's not bad. The stock was off a little bit, but that could just be, you know, the run up was so significant.
Right.
You said software. They're also talking about
the
Omniverse, enterprise, digital. There is more than just the Blackwell, that new technology that was introduced, wasn't there? What else?
That's right. So in tandem, they offered software for inference. Now, in the AI supply chain, you start with your large language model building. And that's what's going to continue to probably happen for another year or so. And then you take all of that great data that you've crunched and you try to create some patterns that actually can be used by folks. And so what they want to do is make sure, since they already own the pie for large language model building, that they keep their lead in the next stage inference. So they announced NIM software, NIM. And what this will do is they are going to charge about $4,500 per GPU per year as a license fee to better be able to use their chips in this inference stage, which is the next stage of AI. Now, the price point is not going to drive revenue like the chips did. But the nice thing about the software licensing model is there are no manufacturing costs. It's 100% gross margin. So pound for pound, it'll be much more profitable. But it's kind of a 1-2 punch that was necessary.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that they're going to be so much more than just a chip maker, the idea that you could, I guess, become more like a Microsoft or somebody with the software aspects to that, that changes the equation, I guess, to some extent, and the profitability of this company.
Yeah, Becky, that's a great point. So what they're trying to do is become the AI ecosystem, kind of like Apple so successfully did with the walled garden, right? You had to have the phone and the watch and the earbuds. So this is what NVIDIA is trying to do here. Build a walled garden ecosystem in AI that'll be durable for many years, that doesn't just include several iterations of the fastest GPUs, but also software and probably other products over time in that bundle. So they're trying to copy that Apple walled garden playbook.
So Paul, we've been told, believe me, we need to be told these things, but we've been told that the training part of deploying an AI system is where you use a really high-level chips. And then the inference, maybe there can be some competition because it's not going to be, you don't need the big GPU computing power. I don't really understand anything. But do you eventually get done with the training where you're not going to need successive generations? Like, I don't know what comes after the Blackwell, but it reminds me a little bit of Moore's Law. I mean, I'm sure that the next one that they design is going to be 30 times more powerful than Blackwell, which was 30 times more powerful than Hopper. Is that still happening with, we're going to need training forever and then also inference? So both of those aspects of AI, of the AI rollout, are going to go on at the same time forever.
Joe, that's a really good point, because if there is an end to the rainbow in large language model building, You're absolutely right. As we get into inference, you still need GPUs, but you don't need the latest and greatest. And that's where somebody like Advanced Micro Devices can step in. So they're trying to protect the moat by offering this NIM software for inference, because once we get through the large language model building, and this is probably the greatest risk with this stock, you know, up fivefold in 2 years, is that, okay, they conquered that step, but what happens with step two? There will be other players. These products will never be commoditized. That would be an overstatement, but there could be some competition coming. And so that gets people worried about not what NVIDIA is going to do financially this year, or maybe even next, but at some point, do they drastically slow down? And if you, as an analyst, feel that that's the case, then at some point, you got to sell the stock.
All right, Paul. You remember Mr. Blackwell, I guess, don't you? Do you remember?
No, I did not.
You didn't remember? He had a worst dress list. I mean, in the old days, he used to design stuff for Jane Mansfield if you needed something to look a certain, but towards the end, he would publish this list. For example, Lindsay Lohan. Oh. Becky was on 4 straight years, and he said that she went from adorable to deplorable. So, and I'm just looking at a couple.
As did her career after that.
He said some real, here's something about Camilla. I'm not going to read that. She looked at a mirror and watched it crack. I'm looking at, he was very funny, very snarky, very funny. This has nothing to do with the Blackwell chip, the Grace Blackwell chip, except it has the same name. Paul Meeks, thank you.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, $418 million, 6% commissions, and countless transactions. We're digging into the biggest change to the real estate business in a century with real estate celeb Ryan Serhant.
Real estate agents are paid in a correlation with their value that they provide to their customer. And that's what you'll see more of going forward.
The real estate broker / Bravo real estate star explains the giant settlement for the National Association of Realtors and the impacts for buyers, sellers, and agents. This is Squawk Pod from CNBC with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan. Here's Becky.
Our next guest is here to weigh in on the recent blockbuster legal settlement by the National Association of Realtors. If approved by a federal court, that deal would eliminate the industry standard 6% sales commission and put money back in the pockets of home sellers. Joining us right now is real estate broker Ryan Serhant. He is the CEO of Serhant. And Ryan, let's just talk about that. I am so confused by everything I've read around this, what this means, how things are coming. I guess you've probably spent a lot more time trying to analyze it. What do you think happened here?
It can be very confusing. The lawsuit alleged that the National Association of Realtors, real estate brokerages, and local MLSs conspired to obligate a seller to pay a buyer's agent's commission. And what the settlement does is it really acknowledges that the traditional brokerage model has to change. And I think, listen, I think we all agree that there should be a free market conversation around compensation. And so what will happen starting this summer, nothing changes for right now around the country, but what will happen starting this summer is that buyers and buyers' agents, if they elect to use one, and sellers' agents, should they elect to use one, because you're not obligated to use a real estate agent in the United States, and you're not obligated to pay 6%, 10%, or 1%. Right. Those fees are what the market has commanded for decades.
It's kind of standard, and it's standard because people don't buy homes every day. So by the time you figure out what's happening, you get to the other side of this. Look, I think there are times when I've absolutely needed a broker, other times where I have not.
Sure.
And it's not easy to figure out or to negotiate on these ends. If everybody thinks that this is the way it should be done, why did it take a lawsuit to get us there?
Oh, I am all for market transparency. And what frustrates me the most, just kind of to what you're saying right now, is that the old guard in this business has spent so much time, so much money, you know, on lawsuits just like this, defending where they've been instead of trying to build to where we're going. I think what happens now is new business models. I think there's new opportunity.
What do those models look like? What happens?
I think there's going to be greater versatility in how you work with your agents. And what's interesting for me is if you look at over the past 10 years, regardless of this lawsuit, all of the new technology, artificial intelligence, websites, iBuying, Zillow, et cetera, humans buying and selling homes have actually elected to use realtors more because it's so complicated. You don't know where to start.
Well, I have to say part of it is a tight market. If you're in a tight market right now trying to find a house, by the time it's on Zillow, it's gone. Mm-hmm. So I think that you absolutely need a broker in a tight market where houses are moving quickly. You need a broker if you are moving to an area that you're unfamiliar with. Mm-hmm. You need a broker if you're a first-time home buyer and you don't know the risks that are associated. You don't know your rights. You don't know what you can and can't ask for along those lines.
Correct. And what you'll have now is greater transparency, which I am a massive, massive proponent for. It's one of the reasons I started my own company. I looked around at what my competition was and a place that I could go as a realtor myself, and I couldn't find the transparency that I wanted. And I think real estate agents are paid in a correlation with their value that they provide to their customer. And that's what you'll see more of going forward. If a buyer wants to use a buyer's agent, there is going to be greater transparency.
Meaning what? The buyer says to the agent, okay, I'll take you on as my agent. You can show me places, but mm-hmm. I'm only going to pay you X percent, or I'll pay you a flat fee. Or, you know, if you get me a house in this amount of time, you can get this percent versus, you know, if you don't meet any of these things, then I'm not going to pay that same level.
Yeah, I think it remains to be seen how this is going to shape out in the open marketplace, right? Yeah. These new rules aren't going to go into effect until sometime, at least over the summer.
I mean, my only hesitation with any of this is I could have done that before.
Sure.
If I was aggressive enough with a broker and
of said, course.
Here's what I'm willing to pay.
Yep.
And here's how this is going to work.
Absolutely. There is no obligation to use a real estate agent in the United States. There's no obligation to pay a higher fee.
With and without them.
Of course. Right. Of course. Now, in New York City, everything's a bit different because there is no, we're not members of the National Association of Realtors in New York City, and there is no MLS in New York City.
I don't get the sense that it's better in New York City.
While New York City is, remember too that using a great salesperson, great service is expensive. Bad service costs you a fortune. And so we see that time and time again. Discount brokerages have existed for a long time. You could sell your own home by yourself. Somebody just listed their own home in Soho for $35 million as a for sale by owner. They could use an agent. Maybe they'll sell, maybe they won't sell. But I think greater transparency is important to bring our industry forward, and I'm for it.
God, I'm thrown back to my brokerage days. Would 1,000 shares be good, or would 2,000 be better for you? I understand how you feel. Many of my clients have felt that way in the past, but they found you got it all down, man. You do. Was this like a Dale Carnegie type
no,
thing?
No. Huh?
Tell me again about so great service, bad service actually costs you in the long run, so you should pay more fees up front. Is that what you said?
No. I think that anytime you're electing to use someone to help you, whether it's an attorney, a real estate agent, a landscaper.
It should cost more.
I think great service can cost more. I think bad service will cost you more in the long run.
In the long run.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Right? If you make a mistake, or if, like you were saying, if you buy a home in a new market that you're unfamiliar with, and you buy in an area that, oh, shoot, I shouldn't have bought there. I didn't have great advice, right? I didn't have great service. You know, but I think greater transparency in the market going forward is exactly what the market's called for. And like I said earlier, I think everyone is on the same page that compensation should be a free market conversation. And that's what you're going to have.
I said yesterday that if you don't have those little yellow things everywhere I need to sign, I can't close on a house. So I will. If I'm selling, I'm using you. If I'm buying, I'm using you. If I'm thinking about selling, I'm using you. So you don't need to sell me. So you didn't need any of that other stuff. Yeah. Do you like the little yellow? Have you seen that?
Yeah, it makes.
Have you tried to close in a different city from where you're buying? You are totally dependent. I mean, you need notaries. You need.
It's complicated.
It's unbelievable. I couldn't possibly do it. So you got me for 6%. I won't even squeal.
Okay. Listen, home prices, right? Home prices are defined by three things, and it's not.
Uh-oh.
Broker's commissions.
Okay, do it.
But it's supply and demand.
Oh, I thought you were going to supply. Location, location, location?
But no, that's part of it. I mean, look outside.
Number one, and then two and three is repeat number one?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like you better in this seat than maybe when you were a broker. No, but it's supply, it's demand, it's interest rates, more so than anything else.
Right. Yeah. And we do have a Fed decision this week. Ryan, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Up next on Squawk Pod, the latest endorsement for Bob Iger in his bitter board battle with activist investor Nelson Peltz. Filmmaker George Lucas is backing Disney in the fight, and it turns out he's the giant's largest shareholder.
Multiple sources have confirmed to CNBC. It's not a well-known fact. You can't find this in SEC filings, but Lucas is the largest shareholder.
We'll be right back after this. You're listening to Squawk Pod with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan.
Up and Becky, cue.
Filmmaker and Hollywood legend George Lucas is throwing his support behind Walt Disney CEO Bob Iger in that bitter proxy battle between the company and activist investor Nelson Peltz. Lucas, who received 37.1 million Disney shares as part of Disney's $4.05 billion purchase of Lucasfilm back in 2012, is currently the largest individual investor in the company. Multiple sources have confirmed to CNBC. It's not a well-known fact. You can't find this in SEC filings, but Lucas is the largest shareholder. And in a statement provided to CNBC, Lucas wrote, "Creating magic is not for amateurs. When I sold Lucasfilm just over a decade ago, I was delighted to become a Disney shareholder because of my long-term admiration for its iconic brand and Bob Iger's leadership. When Bob recently returned to the company during a difficult time, I was relieved. No one knows Disney better. I remain a significant shareholder because I have full faith and confidence in the power of Disney and Bob's track record of driving long-term value. I have voted all of my shares for Disney's 12 directors and urge other shareholders to do the same." Now, Disney has lined up a number of high-profile endorsements in its battle against Peltz and his firm, Trian Management, from the heirs of Walt Disney and Roy Disney to J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon. But the support from Lucas, that endorsement is key, not only as Disney's largest individual shareholder, also because of his standing in Hollywood. Lucas wrote and created the Star Wars and the Indiana Jones franchises, which are some of the most popular films in history. And he helped pioneer tools like digital film editing and computer-generated imagery. So what he says matters. I think, Joe, it's particularly key that Lucas said he was relieved when Bob Iger came back, and that is why he has remained a significant shareholder. I think that's pretty important in going through this. And again, they've lined up a lot of different endorsements. This has been a very hard-fought battle already. That proxy battle ends on April 3rd. That's when we'll see what happened with all of this. Lucas saying that he has voted all of his shares, and he's recommending that others do the same.
I wonder what he's... there'd be tax implications, I guess, if he sold shares.
Right? Oh, sure.
So that's the reason for, I mean, is
yeah,
he diversified?
If you don't believe, I don't know.
What we can glean is that he must be bullish about.
I will tell you, multiple sources have confirmed to me that he is the largest shareholder. But you have some pretty significant shareholders that have come through. One of them is Ike Perlmutter, who Trian, I think, has kind of put out and said that Perlmutter, who used to be the chairman at Marvel, there were three big deals that Bob Iger did. Those three huge ones would be.
It seemed like he overpaid, but didn't.
No, $15.5 billion if you combined Pixar. And Lucas and Marvel, those three, $15.5 billion. Yesterday, Disney put out a little bit of a peek behind the kimono just in terms of the returns. You usually don't get anything even from the franchises that they won't tell you the profitability of these things. But they did go out of their way to say that $15.5 billion that they spent on those three deals were very well made. I think they said they got three times the return on the capital they invested for Star Wars and Avengers. Fivefold increases on the capital they invested in the Toy Story franchise. Just pointing out how these things have really been a flywheel, because that has been one of Nelson Peltz's big criticisms, that he overpaid for all of those deals. Those three, they showed you a little bit about how profitable those deals have been for the company.
I remember, and it seemed like Steve Jobs just he took him to the cleaner with Pixar.
Lorene Powell Jobs, I think, was the largest individual shareholder at one point. I don't believe she is now, but she owned a very substantial stake, a bigger stake, because of the Pixar investment.
I don't know about Pixar anymore. I think that kind of lost its way.
Got another Toy Story that's coming out.
They do?
Yeah.
Just don't think of it the same way. I'm not sure that's been... I don't know if anyone could have at this point. It was obviously the groundbreaker in animation back then, but it's had, you know, a lot of players.
The other thing that you have, though, is the content that it kicks out for the parks,
right,
and what they're able to pick up and run with those things, too. So, again, this is just the next step in the saga that has become this proxy battle. I think Bob Iger has pulled out all the stops and wants to make sure that shareholders understand his point of view from this. A lot of times you have companies that don't come in and kind of play above the fray on these things. That hasn't been the case here. My guess, I don't know anything, but my supposition would be that Bob Iger came back from retirement for this, probably doesn't want to deal with an activist investor, someone he clearly has not gotten along with on the board at the same time. Probably wouldn't make it a whole lot of fun.
Right. No. And I'm still working my way through this ESPN piece, man. A lot of all media has some really daunting challenges. They're actually talking about this guy that runs ESPN as a possible successor, not the leading successor to Iger in 25, but someone that you would need to consider. But depending on what happens with ESPN between now and then, that could determine it too, because that's a microcosm of the challenges that streaming presents for everyone.
You said they lost 30 million subscribers.
Something like 30 million, and I think profitability's down. And I mean, ESPN was the crown jewel all along. What do you do with it?
But it is. Right. It's indicative of the industry at this point.
Right. And we haven't had an update on the. We don't know the name of it. It'd be nice if you get the name so that we don't have to explain what we're talking about. But for the Fox, ESPN,
Warner Brothers
yeah. sports streaming enterprise, we need a name for it so we can talk about it. But I don't know where that, I'm sure there's a lot going on behind the scenes right now.
I would imagine.
Yeah.
That's the podcast for today. Thank you for tuning in, as always. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin every weekday morning on CNBC, starting at 6 Eastern. You can always get the highlights plus a little extra if you follow us here on Squawk Pod, wherever you're listening now. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.